supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Ebola is the latest disease to have its very own narrative. We hear things like airborne and pandemic, and national, worldwide anxiety goes up. This despite scientific evidence to the contrary. Why does this happen? How does it happen? And does it actually affect the course of the disease, or certainly our approach to it? My first guest is Priscilla Wald. She says that we do create narratives around disease that actually affect the course of the disease in our culture. We'll hear more about what she has done in just a minute. Later on, we'll speak with two sociology professors, one who works at a haunted house studying what makes people scared, and the other who's done a study of children and children's responses to fear. But first, Priscilla Wald. She's the author of Contagious: Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak Narrative. It takes a look at the intersection of medicine and myth around the idea of contagion. She's also the author of Constituting Americans: Cultural Anxiety and the Narrative Form. She's also a member of the Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy and an affiliate of the Trent Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities at the Institute for Global Growth. Priscilla Wald, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Your book is almost a classic description of what's happening with the outbreak of Ebola. Only a handful of cases have really occurred outside of West Africa, and several of those were cured. It seems that, you know, when it gets contained, and it looks like it will, the narrative fear seems to continue.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
How come? And
go ahead.
Why?
I think once the fear has been put into play, it's something that the story continues to be a possible future scenario, in fact, an inevitable future scenario. We're always going to have outbreaks. They're going to become epidemics. They're going to become pandemics. So once you have a story of how an outbreak works and of how it threatens to become a species, an apocalyptic or species-threatening event, that fear is going to remain even when this outbreak is contained. There's a sense of, well, it's going to happen again. And so the fear is attached to the story itself and is something that is endemic to that story. So until we change the story, we're going to continue to have the fear and the sense of an impending crisis.
Well, you know, as a shrink, I wonder, you know, what the roots of it are. And I look back into the, you know, the pandemics we've lived through as a culture. And I look at you know, most recently, relatively recently, the worldwide flu pandemic in the early 1900s that killed 75 million people, and more recently, the flu pandemic of 2009. I think that was the avian flu that killed half a million.
It was actually H1N1. It wasn't avian, but it was there were some avian cases. It was swine flu.
And that killed 500,000 people. I wonder if, as a culture, we have recovered from these pandemics, or you know, somehow are they in our very soul?
That's a really interesting question. I guess I would say that the fear is not unwarranted in the sense that these are genuine threats.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the fear in the United States of Ebola is not warranted. And the panic that Ebola or a hemorrhagic fever in particular generates is not, in the United States, is not warranted. We should certainly respect this disease. We should certainly be concerned about this disease. And it is certainly not contained or close to contained yet in Africa. But why is it that people in the United States who, you know, have no contact with this disease are concerned that it's going to get out of control in the United States when there is absolutely no evidence that it will and evidence to the contrary? So again, what I'm interested in is when that fear is realistic and when that fear is seems to be coming from somewhere else. So one of the questions I ask is, why are we in the United States so terrified of something like Ebola? And we don't worry in the same way. It is true that H1N1, the narrative got attached, but in general, a normal or a less severe influenza epidemic is going to kill more people this year, I would venture, in the United States than Ebola will, but we're not going to have the narrative attached to that. Why is that? And I have, you know, one of the reasons, I think, is that it is a titillating, sensational narrative that is really designed to produce this fear, in part because, at least, again, in the United States, this is not true in Africa, but in the United States, it's something really most people don't have to fear, and therefore we can afford to. Whereas with an annual influenza pandemic, or even getting in our car every day, and that's going to be much more risky sure. to most people in the United States, almost everyone, than Ebola, if we were afraid of those things, we wouldn't function. And so part of our fear of Ebola comes from the fact that on some level, everyone in the United States knows it's really going to be contained. That's part of the outbreak narrative.
So in my research, I was, you know, looking up some of the headlines, and I just stopped at CNN. And let me read you a few of their headlines. Why removing an Ebola protective suit is so dangerous. Another, Texas nurse who had worn protective gear tests positive for Ebola. Another, how an Ebola outbreak can start. And finally, oh, and the other one was step inside the CDC's Ebola war room. And just in case our anxiety isn't cranked up enough, one last headline. Can they even make enough Ebola serum? Now, you know, I don't want to put this at the doorstep of CNN. Seems like all news media are doing it. But you're suggesting it's not just news media, that there's a relationship between our generalized anxiety disorder in this culture and the news media.
Well, I guess what I would say, and I would, you know, I would include popular fiction and film, right? This is one of the stories that gets told. My argument would be that ultimately it's a reassuring story. So let me back up a little bit and then respond to your question about the media. This story about hemorrhagic fevers emerged in the 1990s, and it was in part a response to HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm. So in the 70s, there was a lot of sanguinity, a lot of complacency about communicable disease when they found the last naturally occurring case of smallpox. And so the idea was, okay, we've now defeated smallpox and other terrifying diseases are going to go the same way. This is not something we need to be afraid of. And in fact, this is evidence of how, you know, how advanced we are as a civilization, that we can do this, and the next step is going to be cancer. And that was the narrative in the 1970s. And of course, as they were telling that story, Ebola was emerging in various parts of the world. Ebola, other hemorrhagic fevers, were emerging around the world in small outbreaks. But HIV was really making the rounds, and HIV punctured that complacency. HIV said, no, this is not something you've got under control. And along with that complacency, the sense of, you know, look at who we are as a civilization. And so I understand the other hemorrhagic fevers, the outbreaks of which have been very quickly contained. And again, my heart goes out to everyone who has suffered from them and died, and the people who have lost their loved ones. This is not, I'm not to say that this is not a tragic thing. But the outbreaks have been contained very quickly, and so they were, again, evidence that, you know, yeah, we really do have these things under control. Even though we don't have AIDS under control, these other ones that terrify us even more than AIDS because they're really species-threatening, those we can get under control. So that's how I understand the emergence of this outbreak narrative. So it's really ultimately a narrative that makes us afraid but then reassures us and is a reaffirmation of the fact that, you know, things are under control.
So it's,
I think when we get to the media, then, to get to your question,
yeah,
the media has to, you know, news has to sell. Headlines are selling news. Headlines are getting people to watch or buy the paper or read or whatever. And there is a sensationalism, not everywhere. I'm seeing lots of headlines that say nothing to fear or why aren't we afraid of poverty or something. You know, really, really, I'm seeing increasing efforts on the part of the media not to tell this story, but the CNN headlines that you talked about, a CNN headline that compared Ebola to ISIS,
mm-hmm,
called it the ISIS of epidemics. I mean, these are designed to titillate, to sensationalize, and those are the ones that are playing in to the outbreak narrative. So I really want to underscore that I'm seeing both in the media.
Yeah, and it's not just the media. This thing's gotten politicized already. And,
absolutely.
And, you know, I mean, there's some parties that are grilling in public testimony, the CDC, and implying they're lying about it not being airborne. But it's not just those people, Priscilla. More credible sources like Michael Osterholm. He's director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research at the University of Minnesota. I'm sure you're familiar with him. He warned that the risk of airborne transmission is real. And here's a quote: "Until we consider it, the world will not be prepared to do what is necessary to deal with this epidemic."
Well, I think that's a very reasonable thing. I think the problem is, and this is actually where the outbreak narrative in part got its start, the problem is that how do you strike a balance between getting people to take a threat seriously and to address it and not terrifying them? And that's a problem that responsible spokespeople have, that the media has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a genuine problem, because one of the things that the outbreak narrative that I'm talking about did in this case is, on the one hand, it's creating this panic that I've, you know, you and I have been talking about. On the other hand, I think the expectation that this too would be containable, as previous Ebola outbreaks have been, might have caused the World Health Organization and the CDC to react a little bit less quickly than they might have. And again, I don't want to criticize. I'm not there. I'm not making their decisions. They have a lot of information comes at them, and they have, you know, only limited resources. Nonetheless, they are themselves saying we should have been quicker. And so I'm saying, in this case, the other side of this is that the opposite of panic was not calm, but complacency. So how do you strike that balance is a real question. And I would also ask a very important question: why are we worried about this only when it gets to the United States? Why aren't we concerned for the people in Liberia and Sierra Leone, who are really under, you know, much more threat than people in the United States? Why is it only when it comes here that we should address it or worry about it? You know, this should be something that is a humanitarian issue as soon as it happens. And part of my argument is that the outbreak narrative causes us to think of this in crisis terms and very immediate terms, and that, you know, even when the threat isn't upon us, that's how we think about this problem. So we think in terms of quarantine and closing borders and developing vaccines and pharmaceuticals, all really important things. Why are we not thinking about the larger issue of global poverty, which is not only and should be first and primarily a humanitarian issue, but even in this context, thinking in terms of epidemiology and economics, global poverty or poverty is the biggest single vector that turns an outbreak into an epidemic and an epidemic into a pandemic.
Well, wait a minute, though. Let me stop you here. I'm asking you a question. I guess should be directed to a a psychologist who studies these broad issues, but you know, I understand that you're pointing a finger at our cultural thinking, and I agree with you. But, you know, it does beg the question, why? What is it about not just Americans, but our brains, the way we're wired, that has us thinking that way? You know, we are, our evolutionary genes have us thinking, you know, selfishly and about self and about immediate family. And I think the harder work that we have to engage in is how do we kind of grow that thinking from our primordial genes to something that's more evolved, when we can see someone in poverty, see the whole issue of poverty, and feel visceral pain about that, take some ownership.
I think that's a great question. I guess I would say, and this is, you know, you're right, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not a neuroscientist, so I don't study the hardwiring, but I do call it into question, and my argument would be our narratives are what make us think in certain ways. You know, it's impossible to show what is hardwired and what is environmental. That's I don't know that that's a possible distinction to make, but I certainly can say that the way that information circulates through language, through image, through story and plot line, that and that how it travels from the science to the mainstream science writing, fiction, nonfiction, and into the media, how all of that circulates shapes the way we think about the world. Is it evolutionary that we think first in terms of a family? I don't know. I'm a mother, and absolutely my first thought is for my children. I don't know how much of that, and I understand the evolutionary explanation for that, but I would also say there's a cultural explanation for that. I grew up in a world in which I was trained to think first of my own loved ones. My parents thought first about me. I thought first about my children. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Let me start by, and I'm not likely to change it either. But I am saying, why is it? Why can't we extend that? Why can't we think of you know, everybody's rights as the Declaration of Alma-Ata from 1978? You know, that got signed on to by over 150 nations and NGOs that said everybody should have the right to health. The UN has a declaration that tells us, part of human rights, that everybody has the right to health. Why is it so difficult for us to think, and health broadly defined, why is it so difficult to us to tell the story that we should be, as a world, directing our resources in such a way that everybody has the right to the basic parameters of health, food, shelter, access to health care, primary health care? Why can't we think that way?
Let me weigh in on this as a psychologist, a clinician, that, you know, you talk about narrative, and we talk about narrative, too, in the field of mental health. And we know, I know, that the story we tell ourselves about who we are, about the world we live in, about our own history, affects the way we see the world. All of us have a story, whether it's conscious or not, about people are. I am a victim, I am blessed, I have gifts, I have a responsibility, or I have to hide. And that particular narrative can be changed.
Right.
And that will in turn change the narrative you're looking to change.
We are in 100% agreement. Absolutely. Yeah. And it can, the narrative that I study, so I understand you study the individual ones, and of course, the idea of victim, the idea of blessed, all of those things are terms that we learn culturally, right, from our environment, what that means. I look at the big collective ones. I look at the ones that, as a culture, all, you know, having the news circulate around us, having popular fiction and film circulate around us, having conversations circulate around us, as a culture, what are the stories we are telling about disease emergence? What are the stories we are telling about global poverty, about threats, about, you know, where we should be putting our resources. And it seems to me, you know, what I would like to try to do is to investigate the story as you are, but on the cultural level, of what we're afraid of and why we're afraid of it, and therefore how we are directing our resources. Because I think you and I agree that we're very motivated by fear. And I would love to see the story being told in such a way that people, that we as a culture, and that could be the United States, that we could be a group within the United States, it could be broader, it could be, you know, the world. How would it be possible to tell a story such that more resources are directed to addressing the question, for example, of poverty, of people living in such a way that they are not having access to this basic right of health? How could we tell that story?
Speaking of those beautiful sentiments, we're going to have to take a short break. I wonder if you could stay with us for a few more minutes, because I want to ask you a question about your course, the class that you teach, called Human Beings After Genocide. I want to hear the cliff notes of that course. We were talking with Dr. Priscilla Wald. We'll be back after a short break. She's the author of Contagious: Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak of Narrative. Like I said, we'll be back after just a short break. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Hi, I'm Katie Culinary, State Impact Pennsylvania reporter here at WHYY, coming to you on the last day of our fall membership drive. You heard right, it's our last day. We're behind right now, and we need you to help make our mini goals in order to make sure that this service is here for you. You use it, now it's time to support it. WHYY provides an extraordinary powerhouse service. You listen to us every day. You're listening to Voices in the Family right now, so we know that you appreciate it. But what you may not know is that WHYY spends millions of dollars to bring you this amazing programming, and it comes with a price. So when you support WHYY, you're supporting yourself and making sure that this service is here for you when you turn on your radio, when you go to our online streaming. This hour, our goal is 100 pledges by 1 o'clock. I know we can make it. I can't tell you how many times I hear people say, I love WHYY, now it's time to support it. The number, 1-888-345-9499, or online at whyy.org. Thanks.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
Supporting WHYY, Devereaux, one of the leaders in behavioral health care, helps to provide care for children and adolescents with mental health challenges, as well as individuals of all ages living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Across its national network, Devereaux helps provide meaningful care to individuals and families where they need it most. Whether it be through community and educational programs, employment services, foster care assistance, or individual or group living support. Learn more at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about fear today. It's contagion and the stories we tell. We're going to learn more later in the show about what we're afraid of and why we like to be scared, or why some people like to be scared anyway. But for now, we're talking with Dr. Priscilla Wald. She's the author of Contagious: Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak Narrative. So, Priscilla, tell us about Human Beings After Genocide. I want the cliff notes. God,
okay.
I've always wanted to say that to a professor of mine. Give me the bottom line.
Cliff notes. Yeah, so this course is about the idea of human being and humanity following World War II. And what we're looking at is how the sciences that got accelerated by the war effort on the one hand, challenged conventional definitions of what it meant to be human, and on the other hand, how political theorists, responding not only to the atrocities of war, but also colonialism, so this was a moment of heightened decolonization, how those political thinkers tried to, having seen the failure of natural rights and human rights, tried to imagine what definition of humanity they could and human being they could possibly come up with that might prevent such atrocities in the future. What could we all agree on globally that everyone, all nations at any rate, would respect such that these atrocities could be prevented in the future? And of course, it was a very idealistic kind of project, but what we're looking at is how those challenges to the notion of the human worked and how the idea of the human was being rethought in both science and political thought and what we might learn from those efforts.
Would your course answer the question, what does it mean to be human?
Well, would it answer it? It would ask it. What we're looking at...
Anybody can do that.
Anybody can do that, absolutely. We're looking at how political thinkers and scientists were asking that question. So we're studying the way that question was getting asked and how these thinkers were attempting to answer it. So, you know, what was involved in being human? What was human nature? And what could we imagine that humanity might... How could we tell the story of humanity such that we could transcend the problems that had led to or the thinking that had led to the atrocities of war? So for example,
please.
Aldous Huxley's brother Julian was a biologist, an evolutionary biologist, and he coined the term modern synthesis. This was the new way of thinking about Darwin that showed the mechanisms of natural selection, and so evolution was a big part of it. And what he said is if we really understand the biology behind evolution, we will think in terms of species and we'll transcend these cultural differences that are causing all this trouble. So that was his what he offered to the conversation. And he said we will, and he really, you know, he coined the term transhumanism, and he said we will begin to think cosmically and this will lead to world peace. That was his idea. So that's the kind of thing that we're looking at in the class.
My producer, Priscilla, has very gently reminded me that I haven't given out the phone number yet for the whole show, and part of the reason is because I had so many questions I wanted to ask you. But let me give out the phone number now, if you want to join the conversation. We're talking with Priscilla Wald. Later on, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Maggie Kerr, who's a sociologist who does fear research for haunted houses in Pittsburgh. But our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'll be taking your calls. We're talking about fear. It's contagion, and the stories we tell around fear. Priscilla, around 1995, you wrote a book about cultural anxiety. Now, at the same time, I was writing for the Philadelphia Inquirer here, and I wrote about an article about how I felt this country was suffering from a national anxiety disorder. And that was 95, before 9/11. So what's your take on the cultural anxiety we live with today?
Well, it's interesting. The book was actually about the 19th century, but that was when I began my research on the outbreak narrative, and the cultural anxiety that I was seeing in that moment was precisely this outbreak narrative. And one of the, you know, going back to the question you asked me earlier about, you know, people who are responsible, who are telling people, you know, don't take this too lightly, the reason ultimately, the initial reason that Richard Preston wrote The Hot Zone, which appeared in 1994 in The New Yorker and then came out as a book subsequently, and this is what started this whole outbreak narrative about disease emergence, was Joshua Lederberg, who was a biologist, had seen this danger in a primate facility in Reston, Virginia, and it was a case of airborne Ebola, but in this case only transmitted among primates. And he said, you've got to tell this story. We're not prepared. So he's the one who told Richard, who gave Richard Preston the story. And Preston was a journalist. He wrote it very sensationally. And that got people's attention on the problem, people meaning the government. That's what he was trying to do. So, you know, again, where do we balance? How do we tell a story that will get people aware of a problem and willing to address it, but without having the fear actually redirect that anxiety not to something productive, but to something counterproductive?
Where that's the issue I work on in my office every day. It's like fear sometimes carries information, and
right.
sometimes it doesn't. And
right.
how do we listen to the information it carries and be responsive, and how do we jettison off the rest? And that's always the challenge.
Exactly.
Listen, I hear through the grapevine that you've always been interested in the Typhoid Mary story.
Yes.
So how come? What about it?
That was what I got interested in my earlier book, The Cultural Anxiety, that was about how anxiety becomes stigma. So I was interested in how the medical fears fed into our fear of strangers, of immigrants, how it fed nativism in the 19th century. And Typhoid Mary, who was early 20th century, was the tail end of what I was writing about, but she became the impetus for the new book project along with this outbreak narrative. And I find her story fascinating because everybody has vaguely heard of Typhoid Mary, but most people don't know the actual story. She was an Irish immigrant who was working as a domestic servant, and she was the first identified healthy carrier of typhoid or of any contagious disease in the U.S. There were others in Germany and elsewhere. And her being, you know, this came out of bacteriology and new understandings of contagion, but she was the evidence that somebody who was not sick and hadn't been sick could still spread a disease. And this was very important epidemiologically. It was important to public health. The interesting thing is how she was treated compared to how other people who spread the infection more widely than she, typhoid. So there was a dairy farmer in, I can't remember, New Jersey or Pennsylvania or somewhere, who actually infected many more people than Mary Mallon, but was not treated the same way she was. She was imprisoned in a medical facility. She was really criminalized. And there were some reasons for how she was treated, but not to the extreme. And why wasn't this other person treated in the same way? So it became very interesting to me, as she was evidence for public health officials of this problem, she was evidence for me of exactly what you and I were just talking about, that there is some reason for the stories we tell, but that there are factors that come in that are not related to the situation they're supposed to be illustrating. So the fact that she was a woman, the fact that in this case she was sexually active and not married, the fact that she was a domestic servant, all of those things played into her criminalization.
Great, great and important observation. Priscilla Wald, unfortunately, we've got to go and say goodbye to you. We're going to be talking about haunted houses on the next segment of the show, something I'm a little nervous about, but that's another issue. Priscilla Wald, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Priscilla Wald's the author of Contagious Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak Narrative. When we come back, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Margie Kerr, who's a sociologist who does fear research for haunted houses in Pittsburgh. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
I'm Katie Colinari, State Impact Pennsylvania reporter in the newsroom here at WHYY. This is the last day of our fall membership drive. We're trying to get 100 pledges by 1 o'clock, and so far we're not doing so great. So we want to hear those phones ringing. We've got some great volunteers here from the McCarter Theater and WHYY volunteers eating some great food from Khyber Pass Pub. But there's chatting right now, and we want to hear the hubbub of people calling us and giving us their pledges. We want to hear some Wegg Pings. The number, 1-888-345-9499, or online at whyy.org. Just $5 a month, and we'll give you $1 million worth of great radio. You trust us to bring you information, inspiration, great programmings like Voices in the Family. Now, give us the confidence that we need to be able to plan for the rest of our year. Just $5 a month. Consider it right now. 1-888-345-9499, or online at whyy.org. Thanks so much. We appreciate your support.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philofound.org.
Penn's Abramson Cancer Center supports WHYY. Penn created the Center for Personalized Diagnostics to help identify the genetic makeup of each person's cancer. This can help physicians develop personalized treatment options by uncovering what makes a person strong and their cancer weak. Penn brings together clinical trials, immunotherapy, surgery, and proton therapy to help bring the cure within reach for patients. If cancer has touched your life, Penn's Abramson Cancer Center can help. Learn more at thecureiswithin.com or 800-789-PENN.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about fear. What is it all about? Why does it get contagious? Why do we tell our fear stories over and over again, even if the threat is not there? And what are we actually afraid of, and what are we not? We're going to look at the micro now. We looked at macro with Priscilla Wald, now with Dr. Margie Kerr. She's a sociologist who does fear research for haunted houses in Pittsburgh. Now, Margie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
So I am sure now, when you were in high school and an undergraduate, your dream was to do fear research at a haunted house.
I never thought that I would be here, no. I loved going to haunted houses, but the fact that I get to now combine my skills in sociology with haunted houses has been really great.
So, why do we like to be afraid?
There's a lot of reasons why, and they stem from, you know, individual just preferences to bigger social context, but you know, at the very kind of physiological level, we do get the nice endorphins and adrenaline and dopamine and all of the chemicals that are activated when we go into that threat response. But if we know we're safe, if we know that we are not going to actually be hurt, then we can enjoy it and really kind of reap the benefits from some of those chemical responses. And then also just, you know, psychologically, it feels really good. You come out of a haunted house or you make it through a scary movie and you've got this feeling of confidence that you just challenged yourself in a way and overcame one of your fears. And so you get a nice self-esteem boost.
Wouldn't that work if you kind of hit your head against the wall over and over and over again? I mean, would you get that same kind of relief when you were done?
I don't know. That sounds like it would be more physically painful than walking through a haunted house or riding a roller coaster. The balance between, you know, physical pain and you know, being startled, I think is, you know, it's when it crosses that line to actually hurting, I don't think that's going to be as much fun.
I'm curious about universal fears, and I'm making assumptions here about what some of them are. Snakes, rats, spiders for older people, universal fear of incontinence. Why are they universal fears?
Well, I think that we, you know, are sensitive to anything that is going to kind of activate one of our senses. So something that startles us, something that, a blast of air, a flash of light, something that feels, different, that's going to universally kind of get a threat response. But in terms of the actual stimuli that everybody is afraid of, I think that there still needs to be a lot of research, to show that they are indeed kind of hardwired fears. There is research looking at why someone who has never been exposed to a snake would have a threat response to a snake. Historically, these are the things that have presented the biggest threat to humankind. Just going back into ancient times when we were very vulnerable to the natural environment, and these were the things that would kill us. So, snakes, bugs, the ability to say concretely that yes, these are kind of universal, evolved, hardwired fears. It's still difficult to say.
I wonder about fear across the lifespan. So what's scary for a 10-year-old might not be so for adults. And when you're developing a haunted house, what are the ethics here?
Yeah, I think that you really do have to be very careful about what kind of stimuli you're using to scare people in a fun way. I'm a big advocate for not exposing children too young to things that are going to be traumatic. They've got to reach that stage of development where they understand that what they're seeing is not real. Prior to that, if they are believing that they are seeing a real, ghost or a real goblin, that can be very traumatic. So you do have to be careful. And with children, it's I think, important to go more towards fantasy, imagination, things that are fun and, potentially startling without being traumatic explicit.
Well, we've got a fellow sociologist on the line to join us, Dr. Cindy Del Clark. She's local here at Rutgers, and she's done an interesting study about how and why some kids are really terrified of Halloween and various other things. Cindy, thanks so much for joining us. Do we have you? I guess we don't have her on the line for the moment. We've got a glitch in it. But it does change over the life cycle what we're afraid of. I used to enjoy being afraid when I was younger, and I don't like it so much now.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, Cindy, we've got you. Yes. I want to come back to this, what scares children and what doesn't. Could you just tell us about your study, just very briefly?
Yes. I'm an anthropologist, actually, and we study ritual, which is really interestingly related to what Priscilla Wall was talking about narratives of fear, because anthropologists think of rituals as the enactment of a narrative. So you might think of Halloween as the enactment of a fear narrative of the same type that Priscilla was talking about. She said that it's something titillating and sensational, but it's about something you really don't have to fear, so you can afford to be fearful. It's almost like you take a little glance at the fear of death at Halloween, but for adults at least, it's a bracketed glimpse, and it's lampooned, and it's a fear that adults are very much in control of because they're the ones that decorate the yards and greet the children as they arrive at their door.
What about children?
Well, I think it's very important to consider it from a child's perspective, and that's what I do in all my work. For children, Halloween is an invitation to be big for a day, and they wear costumes that look like what they perceive as powerful adults, everything from a fireman to Superman for boys who associate adult power with physical strength. or for a pretty costume for girls who associate adult power with aesthetics and looks. And they go out into the world, are allowed to knock on the doors of strangers, something that's usually not permitted, and they have a kind of a ritual threat, trick or treat. Either you give me a treat or I'll trick you. The tricks have been less and less in the recent years. And then adults give them something that's usually a controlled substance, candy. And when
You got to be careful when you say adults give them a controlled substance.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah,
from a child's perspective, candy is under control because you have to brush your teeth afterwards. You're only allowed so much during the day. Sometimes it's completely forbidden. And here is a day when all of a sudden adults are doing the very opposite. Halloween is a topsy-turvy holiday when children gain power and everything is let out of the closet that is usually closeted, including death. And your fear of haunted houses as a child rings very true with my own research. The children that I talked to in the study that I wanted to tell you about were 6 and 7 years old. And haunted houses to these children are the most fear-inducing of all the icons of Halloween because they contain all the other icons of Halloween. And at Halloween, adults are lampooning death. Just as we said, it's bracketed, it's mocked, it's just temporary, and adults know it's not real. But when you show pictures, neutral pictures, of ghosts and Dracula and mummies to 6 and 7-year-olds, they're reminded of those characters in a more literal way. They are moved to tell you that that's a dead person that's wrapped up, that that's a person who wants to kill people.
How does this knowledge, what you're studying, I want to come back to you, Margie. I'd like to hear the two of you talk. How does this inform you, Margie? Are you familiar with Cindy's work?
Yeah, I actually don't really... I don't like seeing really young kids go through haunted houses. You know, most of the haunts around Pittsburgh, at least, are for at least 7 and over. I really do think that a lot of the haunted house environment, you know, today the effects are so realistic that it is too real for young kids. So, you know, I like to see that age group, 7 and under, go to things like a corn maze or something else that engages with the Halloween spirit but is not as realistic and potentially traumatic for them.
Yeah, I would think, Cindy, going back to you, children don't have filters on there and don't have the gifts of denial, so that when they see death, I mean, it's very real. I mean,
it's absolutely true. If a child has a parent that dies around Halloween time, many of the adults I talk to don't enjoy Halloween because they still have the memory of an actual death happening then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I agree that not only in terms of haunted houses, but for all of us who decorate our yards in very scary ways, or maybe give out the treats in a bowl that looks like a skull, I think we need to be a lot more sensitive that we don't always understand how children are reacting, that they're more fearful than they show, because the Halloween is asking them to put on their bravest self. And yet children have nightmares about Halloween afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
It is a much more stressful experience. And I've done participant observation where I went on lots of haunted rides, haunted houses, and so on, and you inevitably see a child who is completely full of crying and screaming because they've been brought to it too early. So I think what we all need to do, including those of us who host children at our doors, is we need to have a "you must be this tall" sign in our mind all the time.
That
tells us to be very gentle and sensitive about not forcing something scary on a kid who's too young to laugh it off.
Hmm.
Yeah, I completely agree, and it's all about that choice, you know, and you're engaging with this material because you want to, and you know that it's fake. And even as an adult, you know, we're not really going to enjoy this kind of scary material if we're being forced to engage with it. And so with kids, yeah, I absolutely agree. It has to be, they have to know what they're getting into.
I want to, Margie, You've got a book coming out called One Brave Woman's Adventures Amid Ghosts, Spiders, Snakes, and Other Things We Love to Fear. Are you that brave woman?
Yeah, I like to think so. This past year, I've been traveling everywhere, doing as many scary and thrilling things as I possibly can to see what it feels like, you know, from a individual approach. I've been looking at fear from a sociological perspective for so long, and I really just wanted to kind of experience it so I could talk about it at a different level. And I have to say, after this past year, I do have an amazing sense of confidence and self-esteem that I really don't think I had before. So I do believe that these experiences that, you know, really challenge you to confront your fears, they do leave you feeling so much more confident.
Yeah. Well, we know that in my field, too, you know, in psychotherapy. Margie Kerr,
sure.
Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it. And you...
Boy, yes, thank you.
You got an interesting job. We also heard from Dr. Cindy Del Clark. She's a sociologist at Rutgers. Earlier on, we heard from Dr. Priscilla Wald, author of Contagious Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak Narrative. Hey, next week, we're going to be talking about family business. And speaking of family business, our dear friend and producer, Gita Simons, is going to be leaving to work with her family's family business. This is her second tour of duty, and she did not get hazardous duty pay this time, although she probably earned it. So, Gita, thank you so much for everything. Best of luck, and really look forward to eating at those restaurants of yours. Well, you can download our podcast at whyy.org/voices and reach me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for the show's been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
I'm Katie Culinary, coming to you on the last day of our fall membership drive here at WHYY. I'm going to give you the number first, 1-888-345-9499, or online at whyy.org. That's what you do if you want to make a pledge this hour, and you really should consider it. We spend millions of dollars here at WHYY to bring you really what is a priceless service, trusted news and information that comes from people in our award-winning newsroom and the programming from NPR. We have Here and Now coming up next, and we know that you value these programs. So tell us, consider giving.